Good afternoon. My name is Rochelle, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Multi-Jurisdictional MCAT conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Dr. Haug. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, operator, and welcome everyone to this Contractor Advisory Committee meeting, aka CAC. Our purpose today is to obtain advice from CAC members and other subject matter experts about the strength of the published evidence on percutaneous vertebral augmentation, specifically for osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures and other diagnoses. In addition to discussion, participants will vote on pre-distributed questions. All speakers must have completed and returned the disclosure statement. The meeting is also open to the public as observers. Just a quick review of the topic. Osteoporosis, or low bone density, causes fractures from normal activities like coughing or bending over, affects 50% of people over 50. One quarter are vertebral compression fractures, which can cause pain and other morbidity comparable to a hip fracture. Treatment options range from non-surgical, such as analgesics, limited activity, bracing, and physical therapy, to procedures such as percutaneous vertebral augmentation, today's topic. Vertebroplasty is the percutaneous injection of bone cement under image guidance into the fractured vertebral body. Kyphoplasty adds balloon tamponade to create a cavity prior to cement injection. Both are meant to immobilize the fracture, reduce pain, and improve alignment, all basic tenets of fracture treatment. Successful small European studies introduced vertebroplasty to the U.S. in 1993, and by 2007, encouraging observational studies led to medical society endorsement in painful fractures refractory to medical management. Subsequent early open-label randomized control trials, including VERTOS, FREE, and VERTOS 2, and others, found a benefit of vertebral augmentation over non-surgical management. However, the lack of blinding meant these results were vulnerable to placebo effect. Two high-profile randomized control trials, published in the New England Journal in 2009, addressed this vulnerability by comparing vertebroplasty to a sham procedure. Both studies found no statistically significant benefit of vertebroplasty. Consequently, some national organizations and professional societies withdrew or curbed support. Others, citing methodological flaws, largely discounted the studies. Medicare coverage continued, but claims data showed the percent of vertebral fracture patients getting augmentation dropped from 24%, so about a quarter, to 14% between 2008 and 2014, a 42% drop. The VAPOR trial, published in 2016, attempted to address the methodological flaws of the New England Journal studies, including with what they considered to be closer to a true sham, subcutaneous, not periosteal anesthetic injection. VAPOR found a significant benefit of vertebroplasty over sham in patients with acute fracture, defined as less than 6 weeks, in severe pain, defined as at least 7 on a 10 scale, especially among patients symptomatic enough to be hospitalized. The authors concluded that vertebroplasty is superior to true placebo in control of severe pain in acute fracture. In 2018, VERTOS 4 essentially replicated the VERTOS 2 study, acute fractures with moderate to severe pain, but addressed the lack of blinding in VERTOS 2 with an active sham or control treatment similar to the New England Journal studies, pedicle periosteal infiltration. Although the reduction in pain score was clinically and statistically significant in both groups, scores did not differ between groups. The authors concluded the results suggest that periosteal infiltration alone in the early phase provides enough pain relief with no need for additional cementation. Also in 2018, a study of Medicare claims data by our co-moderator, Dr. Joshua Hirsch, found that lower percutaneous vertebral augmentation utilization was significantly associated with a 4% increase in propensity-adjusted mortality risk. Finally, two very recent systematic reviews were not supportive of vertebral augmentation. The 2018 Cochrane Review of 21 trials concluded the data, quote, does not support a role for vertebroplasty for treating acute or subacute osteoporotic vertebral fractures in routine practice. Correcting for open trial biases would likely drive any benefits observed towards the null in keeping with findings from the placebo-controlled trials. A 2019 systematic review and meta-analysis by the American Society for Bone and Mineral Research Task Force included, quote, vertebroplasty does not work to relieve pain from the fracture, and kyphoplasty should generally only be done in the context of a placebo-controlled trial. This was obviously a very cursory overview of the tentpole literature. Doubtless, we'll hear of other studies and other interpretations of these studies. Because the recent spate of negative publications partially instigated today's meeting, I think some assume our goal today is to eliminate Medicare coverage. Not true at all. Our goal is to determine what's best for Medicare patients, wherever that leads. To get there, however, we want to hear from all sides. Both proceduralists and non-proceduralists have equal standing in management of patients with osteoporotic vertebral fracture. And now I'd like to ask Dr. Hirsch, if they've opened your line, would you like to add anything?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Howe. Hello, everybody. My name is Josh Hirsch. I've been doing vertebral augmentation since the 1990s, and I'm working here in Boston, Massachusetts. I think Dr. Haug provided the necessary background of how we got to be on this call. I would say to the folks on the call that there are quite a few people, as this is multi-jurisdictional. As Dr. Haug mentioned, there are probably three different groups on this call. People who are here to be informed, although probably everybody would do well to keep a mind their mind open and be willing to be informed. There are people who would think of themselves as proponents of vertebral augmentation, and other people who are not supportive of doing this procedure. I think with the incredible amount of data, it's fair to say that both of the groups who are thinking that they're either for or against the procedure believe themselves to be data-driven, and in their minds are making supportive comments for patient care in this vulnerable population that gets osteoporotic compression fractures. It's our hope that we foster respectful dialogue so that people who are here to be informed are able to make the best data-driven decision. Dr. Haug shared with me this morning that 100 people have filled out disclosure paperwork. We're not certain whether that means 100 people wish to speak today. We would point out that everybody who filled out disclosure paperwork could speak, but should not feel obligated. There are multiple subject matter experts from all aspects of this debate who have agreed to participate in this discussion today. So anyone who filled out the disclosure paperwork should feel free to comment, but otherwise does not necessarily have to comment. We will surely cover all aspects of these six questions, I think, in detail in this next session. With that, why don't I hand it back to Dr. Haug for the first question.
Thanks, Dr. Hirsch. Before starting the discussion, I'd like to go over the voting question format, one familiar to those who have participated in CMS's MedCAC. To both maximize discussion time and have the most informed votes possible, I'm going to ask people to vote after, not during the meeting. CAC members and invited subject matter experts have had at least a week to review the final voting questions. A couple days ago, we sent out an Excel version which should make it even easier to understand and log votes. For each voting question, please use the following scale identifying your level of confidence, with a score of 1 being low or no confidence, and 5 representing high confidence. Some questions have what seem like multiple choices, but each is actually a sub-question which should be scored individually on the scale of 1 to 5. Please use whole numbers only. The first 4 questions are vertebroplasty specific, followed by an identical kyphoplasty set of 4. Within each set, or of those two sets of four, are three questions directed at augmentation skeptics. Questions 9 and 10 are directed at augmentation advocates, neither vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty specific. The last four questions, 11 through 14, are for advocates and skeptics alike. One clarification on question 13, how confident are you that each of the below specialists should be involved in the decision to use vertebral augmentation? I meant that to be as part of a to be taken as part of a multidisciplinary team consensus. Also, some people sent in answers ahead of time, in some cases even on draft versions of the questions. To ensure everyone's answering the same questions with the same explanations in mind, we're only counting votes submitted after today's meeting. Please mark your score directly in column B on the spreadsheet next to each question and return it to your Mac, ideally via email rather than snail mail. Only aggregate, not individual scores will be published, so don't be shy. Any questions on the format? Operator, if we could see if there's any questions on the format that I've explained.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number one to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And your first question comes from Patricia Dower with Professional Surgery.
Thank you.
Oh, hi. The sheet that I have in front of me, I printed out the stuff so I could have it like handy. It just has the questions in blue and yellow and then an answer 1 through 5 column. That's where we put the numbers?
Yes. In column B, you should be able to, and again, ideally you would do it on the Excel file so everything can be handled electronically and it would make it easier for us to tabulate quicker and more accurate, because if we have to transcribe written information, you know, there's always a chance of getting it wrong. So, yeah, column B, in those a yellow or blue spaces, you can put in a 1, 2, 3, or 4, or 5. If they're blacked out, that means that, you know, that's not anything to put an answer to. That's not a voting area.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Next question?
Your next question, line of Gordon Mortensen.
Yes, go ahead.
No,
there's another question.
Yeah, the question was answered, so I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I don't see any of the questions in the queue, operator, so I guess we'll go on. Besides the voting questions, there are six discussion questions. As the operator mentioned, press star 1 to enter the question queue. The first time speaking, and I'll have to remind people of this, I'm sure, give your name, specialty, state, affiliation, and importantly, any relevant, just relevant conflict of interest. So not necessarily all your conflicts of interest that you might list generically, but just any that are relevant to this topic. Subsequently, if you make another comment, I think just your name will suffice, and actually the operator, I think, announces that anyway. Please keep comments evidence-based and focused. And as Dr. Hirsch said, respectful. I know there's a lot of passions on each side. And limited to a few minutes so as many as possible have a chance to weigh in. Today we have the great benefit of 16 subject matter experts, many of them nationally known, and many nominated by an alphabet soup of national specialty organizations you probably recognize. So in the interest of time, I'd ask the many CAC members on the call, again, this is because this is a national CAC, in effect, there are a lot of them, to first give them a chance to address your points before weighing in. So with that, let's go to the first discussion question, which is a branch of question 5. And question 5 is similar to question 1, and basically question 1 is vertebroplasty specific, 5 is kyphoplasty specific, but otherwise they're the same. How confident are you that there is adequate published evidence that augmentation, vertebral or kyphoplasty, improves health outcomes, symptom status, functional abilities, health-related quality of life over non-surgical management in select cases of osteoporotic vertebral compression fracture? And so the actual question, that was the question number five. And the discussion question is, if the result of question, this question, was of at least intermediate confidence, defined as at least three or more on that scale of 1 to 5, please discuss clinical parameters that would impact the choice of kyphoplasty or vertebroplasty. Dr. Hirsch, can you pick us off on this one?
Thank you, Greg. So there are multiple trials on vertebroplasty versus active control sham, passive control sham, and Dr. Hogg listed them in his introductory remarks. Kyphoplasty has not been similarly studied. It has been studied in the free trial in an open label fashion. So the question comes up whether or not, one, we look at vertebral augmentation all the same, vertebroplasty and or kyphoplasty, or there's a difference in how we should think of them as they relate to maximized medical management. So we would like these questions answered for both vertebroplasty, kyphoplasty, and then as they relate to each other.
Okay, operator, if we could see if anybody has a question on this.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star, then the number 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Yeah, and I should say not necessarily a question, but a comment to the question.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1. We do have a question from Craig Lehman.
Yeah, hi. I apologize. This is a simple question, which is I don't have the Excel spreadsheet. I have the various PDFs with the questions. So is there a way for somebody to send me the Excel spreadsheet to record my vote?
Sure. We'll definitely get that done.
Thank you.
And there are no other questions at this time.
As Dr. Hogg mentioned, the use of the word questions may be slightly modified to be questions or comments, unless everybody feels that they are comfortable to answer these questions. We have multiple subject matter experts who can speak to these various questions.
Operator, if you could, I see there's somebody in the queue, if you could.
And your next question comes line of Douglas line. Bill.
Yes. This is Douglas Beal, interventional radiologist from Oklahoma. I'd like to take Dr. Hirsch's comments in reverse order. There has been literature, most prominently a meta-analysis from Pop and Stasel comparing vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. There are other meta-analyses as well that come down to three basic differences between vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. So, you know, one, vertebroplasty is consistently less effective in terms of pain. In the meta-analysis, it was statistically significantly less effective in benefiting quality of life differences. And the third is mortality difference, and this doesn't come from the meta-analysis. It comes from the most recent article, two by Edmund and one by Ong, stating a significant and consistent reduction in mortality of kyphoplasty over vertebroplasty. So, in reverse order, kyphoplasty hasn't been studied against sham. Kyphoplasty has lots of open-label trials. Vertebroplasty, in terms of adequacy of evidence, has been compared against sham, but the issue there was brought up by the Cochrane analysis and the response to that by Dr. Bill Clark recently, where these were heterogeneous groupings of level one trials put all together and analyzed in one trial. And so this kind of violates the Cochrane analysis protocol. So this was a breach of protocol, and this was recently published. So I think these comments in terms of heterogeneity and combination of level one evidence, these can't be combined. The two New England Journal articles from 2009, in fact, have been categorized as level two articles by the Anderson-Taunts meta-analysis in 2013 using the preferred reporting items and the levels of evidence for primary research as espoused by North American Spine Society. So these are challenges. You can't combine heterogeneous groups into a homogeneous meta-analysis and call it an Oxford level 1A.
Thank you, Doug. Are there any additional comments in the queue?
There are no questions at this time.
Craig, Sunil Lala, perhaps Dr. Beal mentioned it, but and I missed it, but Dr. Beal, did you have any conflicts of interest that you wish to divulge?
Operator, if you could open his line again, that was my error for not catching that.
And at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad, Dr. Beal.
Thank you. I have numerous conflicts of interest, quite a few, in fact. The good summary of that is generally collaboration with medical device companies for technology development.
But you also, I believe, specifically have a consultant for Medtronic, right?
I have Medtronic. I have Stryker, Smith & Nephew. DePuy Synthes, Johnson & Johnson. So I have numerous. I have roughly 30 conflicts of interest listed there, and these are all listed in their entirety. And there are such things as non-financial conflicts of interest as well. So I have a whole bevy of them.
Thank you, Dr. Beal.
Any other comments? Let's put it more like comments on this particular topic: kyphoplasty versus vertebroplasty. I think, in general, a lot of the society comments about augmentation, in general, lump them together. Dr. Hirsch, do you think that's incorrect or correct?
No, I think that that's correct, and thank you for asking. I want to be careful as a co-moderator to not inject too many of my own opinions, so I'm being a little careful in my comments. But I will say that historically, the vertebral augmentation thought, again, not amongst proponents of one procedure versus the other, was that the pain relief was equivalent between vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. And because the pain relief was equivalent, and for a long time that was really one of the leading considerations of whether we judged the procedure to be successful or not, it seemed appropriate to lump together vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty. And I think strong arguments could be made for still doing that today. After all, in 2019, the main reason these procedures are done in osteoporotic patients is for pain relief. Dr. Beal, who's really made the only comment thus far, did point to certain studies that have highlighted differences between vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, whether that leads to societies changing their practice parameters and guidelines going forward to differentiate the two, I do not know. I would wonder if there are any more comments, though, since Doug made his.
Operator, I think we have another commenter.
We have a question from Alan Brooke.
Yes, hi. Thank you very much for putting everything in this context. One quick comment is that the earlier trials who were comparing the sham injections of lidocaine in the vertebroplasty patients, just to make it clear for people who don't do the procedure, that both populations did very well. It wasn't the fact that the vertebral augmentation or vertebroplasty did not work. That's one important point. The second one is many of the populations who get vertebroplasty instead of kyphoplasty are sometimes sicker, and they're more difficult patients to control, and the devices for vertebroplasty are much cheaper than anything implanted into vertebral body or with balloons. So they're, even though you can lump them all together and say that they have very good pain management-wise, there are slight differences, and the literature doesn't always capture that, but the people, the surgeons who do these procedures, know these subtleties, and over the last multiple decades, the efficacy of these is very hard to tease out based on the literature alone, but clearly both have good safety profiles, and they clearly have efficacy, at least the literature that I've read.
Thank you, Alan. I think Dr. Brooks' points could be encapsulated into two major thoughts. The first is, in talking about the trials that demonstrated equivalency, it was really the active control arm doing well, and perhaps that's a difference with the vapor trial that Dr. Hogg had mentioned in the beginning. And the second point would argue that vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty would likely potentially still be lumped together in the clinical guidelines, with one difference between vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty being the cost of the procedural implements itself.
Thanks, Dr. Hirsch. Operator, we have Dr. Beal coming on again.
Your next question comes from the line of Dr. Beal.
Okay, let me try to encapsulate the differences. There's two sets of differences. So one is an improvement in pain and a statistically significant improvement in quality of life of kyphoplasty over vertebroplasty. That's a pop and Stasio meta-analysis. The other one is a statistically significant improvement in mortality and morbidity of kyphoplasty over vertebroplasty. That's the Edmund paper. Second Edmund paper, and that is a paper by Ong published last year. Another difference between kyphoplasties, and I know we lump these in, but there is differences in approved kyphoplasties with implants, is from the SACOS trial, meaning there's a statistically significant benefit over an implant augmentation in that trial for pain, for height reduction, and for decrease in adjacent level fractures of implant reduction, titanium implant reduction improvement, but statistically significantly better than bone kyphoplasty. So hopefully that will encapsulate the differences.
Dr. Beal, do you think vertebroplasty is superior to just the periosteal, the active sham that was used in a number of the trials that did not show a benefit?
The real problem is there's a heterogeneous grouping here, and if you tell the difference, if you set up a study to determine difference, there's a clear difference, but the study has to be done correctly. For example, the vapor trial established a difference. So did the VOAP trial that was not discussed in the most recent Cochrane analysis. And
the VOAP was not published, right?
Yeah, it was published, but not in a public arena. It was published as part of somebody's thesis. But we do have access to that manuscript. So the difference is clinically relevant reported difference. So the difference between that was clinically relevant between the reported groups is different than a mean subject mean difference. So if you take the mean differences between groups, if you take Virtus 4, for example, the mean difference between groups was in that the sham was a 4.75 point reduction in pain. You add to that, which is inappropriate, as according to Farrar and Katz, this has been recommended against doing exactly this, but you add the minimally clinically important difference to that of 1.5. Virtus 4 had a 6.25 point reduction in pain that was necessary to show a difference. To put that into average scope and scale so people can understand what I'm saying, is that there's nothing in medicine that does that. I looked and analyzed hip arthroplasty, so hip replacement data is a 4.8. An anterior cervical discectomy and interbody fusion of the cervical spine is all, at most a 5.1 point difference. So my point is, by comparing the group mean differences and looking for a difference plus MCID, it creates an impossibly high bar. And there's no literature, none, that I looked through, with the exception of kyphoplasty, that beats that 6.25. And I'm referencing the Evolve trial of a 6.3-point reduction in pain. I'm also referencing the largest registry in the United States, United States Vertebroplasty, Vertebral Augmentation Registry, that was done by Society of Interventional Radiology, that had a 6.7-point reduction in pain. But other than those two differences, kyphoplasty, there's nothing we do in medicine, no surgery, no medication, no treatment that we do that would best that impossibly high bar of Virtus 4. And that comes from the difference between the average means rather than a clinically relevant response difference.
But didn't just the periosteal infiltration reach that level also?
So here's another important difference. Periosteal infiltration does not reach the same difference. So the average reduction in pain for the 2009 New England Journal articles was about the same. The Buckbinder reduction in pain was a 2.3. The Kalmus, I'm referencing the lead authors, was a reduction in pain of 3. The reduction in pain in the Theranescu trial, Virtus 4, was a 4.75. So these are very heterogeneous. And let me reference the vertebroplasty reduction in pain, for example, in the Buckbinder trial was a 2.3. So we have a real methodology problem, because in the United States Registry, the average reduction in pain all across the country with all the participants, the mean reduction was a 6.7. So that's, you know, almost three times the benefit for vertebral augmentation that we get every day around the country as compared to the Buckbinder trial for vertebroplasty. And it's more than twice that of the INVEST trial.
Yeah, I understand that in the 2009, one of the criticisms was the patient selection criteria were not that good. But in the Virtus 4, again, just to be clear, that the active sham was, they both had basically statistically insignificant difference. Are you saying that somehow the sham group was different than the non-sham group in Virtus 4?
So no, Dr. Haug. What I'm saying is to use the difference, the mean difference between the groups, takes a much higher number, much higher number. So let me compare Virtus 4 versus the Buckbinder trial. Buckbinder also used the mean difference between groups. Yeah. Vertebroplasty and sham had 35 and 38 patients. Statistically, if you were to analyze that paper and plan this project, you would need 120 patients in each group instead of 35 and 38 to detect that MCID. So there's no way at 78 total patients you can get that when what you need is 240. And so for Virtus 4, they had more patients, but the critical error is they still used the mean difference between the MCID, which creates what I was saying previously, a 6.25 point betterment of vertebroplasty. That's an impossibly high bar. You could have put whatever compared to sham and Virtus 4 and come out with a negative trial, including cervical fusion, arthroplasty, pain pumps, neuromodulation, epidural injections, RF ablation, anything that we do.
You're saying the difference, that they're that close, that to have a power to show, if there, let's assume there was a small difference, that it would have required to be much more powered to show that difference.
Yes, and this has been described. I mean, the vapor trial, for example, was published in Lancet, they used a clinically relevant difference between the means, between the groups. And that was powered, they had a little bit in excess of 120 patients, and that was statistically significant. And they had a reduction, significant reduction in pain at a predefined time point, and that was statistically significant. They also used a different sham, but the point is the vapor trial compared the mean difference, the clinically relevant response between the groups, and was able to determine a clear statistically significant benefits of vertebroplasty over sham. And the Buckminder trial, for example, it would have needed 3 to 4 times as many patients for each group to determine that. And for the vapor trial, it's the same thing. It's an impossibly high bar. Having said that, the Cochrane analysis included these two heterogeneous groups in one meta-analysis, even though they were very different. They used a different technique, different patient population, different statistical significance calculation. And last time reading through the Cochrane analysis, this is a breach of their own protocol. And this, again, was published very recently. The Cochrane analysis was published in to try to correct the previous error, again in November, as compared with April. And there's a Cochrane vertebroplasty misrepresentation article published in as an evidence-based medicine analysis very recently. And,
okay.
Yeah, this was a British medical journal, evidence-based medicine.
All right. Thank you.
It discusses that, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll be coming back to you. So, operator, if we could get to the next question. I think we have a CMD.
Your next question line on Robert Kellen.
Hi, this is Dr. Kellen with WPS, and we're having trouble hearing the speakers. I wonder if everybody could speak up a little more, please. That's all I have.
They sound okay to me. Anybody, are the other CMDs on the call? Anybody else having trouble hearing?
Not here,
Craig. For how widespread this is.
No. We hear it fine.
I can hear him very fine.
Okay. It sounds like it might be a local issue. Operator, if you could open the line of the next person, but I have a question for that person before she speaks. Is this Dr. Pollock?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We don't have a disclosure form on file for you. Did you fill out one?
Just what have with my normal JCAC 5, not through this particular meeting.
You're a CAC member?
Yes.
Okay. If you could send us in one of those, but in the meantime, if you could just give us the information and any conflict of interest that you have on the topic.
Yeah, no conflicts of interest whatsoever. I'm a neurologist in Michigan, with Michigan Institute for Neurologic Disorders. The only question I had, I know we've been talking about pain management and pain control with the kyphoplasty versus vertebroplasty. Can anyone answer for me two things? One, what is the difference in motor activity, like the modified Rankin scores with these individuals? Is there a difference? And then the second is, what is the difference in dollars that we're talking between these two procedures?
Dr. Hirsch, do you have an answer?
So I'll answer how I would from just my own thoughts. This is not things I've validated. First of all, thank you for asking the question. I don't think that a modified Rankin score would typically be applied in this population unless we were looking at stroke rehab patients, which would be a fairly uncommon group to consider for augmentation. So I don't know of any literature that specifically is using that, but that could be my own ignorance of such a paper, and I would invite other subject matter experts. With respect to vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, the question is probably somewhat nuanced. There are equipment cost differences, and also Medicare reimbursement differences. Therefore, I wouldn't want to be flipped in answering. I would also say that I recently saw data that suggests that kyphoplasty long-term compares favorably with vertebral augmentation in terms of overall cost, whereas there is a higher upfront cost that mitigates over time. Where I saw that, I can't remember, and I don't remember the specific reference. There is existing literature in Virtus 2, et cetera, that does compare in euros the cost of people managed with vertebroplasty versus conservative therapy. And while the cost was a little higher, again, over time, that certainly mitigates. These are thoughts from my head rather than specific answers to your question. So if other subject matter experts could answer the CAC number, please feel free to press, I think it's star one.
So there is nothing that, no literature that talks about improvement in pain versus how well they're doing their activities of daily living, not just for stroke, just in general?
No, I think there's extensive literature about that in all the trials, but we wouldn't compare it. I thought you were asking specifically against the six-point MRS. I only use the modified Rankin score as it relates to stroke, but that may be a limitation of my own practice.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be just with MRS. Any type of, just talking about, is there any difference in the motor activity, getting back to ADLs, that type of thing between the two procedures?
So, I mean, there are numerous, all the studies study quality of life and things of that sort. I want to be careful about answering with respect to motor skills. And in the comparisons of these different procedures, vertebroplasty versus the actual comparator, which is conservative therapy, or kyphoplasty against the actual comparator. So we're removing the studies that looked against sham because that's not something that one would do in real-life practice. There's tremendous advantages in terms of return to function, quality of life, et cetera. In the equivocal trials against sham, one did not see that type of sustained difference. But as I said, one can't do sham in the clinical arena. There were some small trials or some trials of vertebroplasty versus kyphoplasty, but I don't want to speak to them with respect to how those folks did with respect to quality of life. In general, I would say that to get back to an earlier point, when people would think of vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty, they would think of them both as having significant impact on improvement of pain and functional outcomes versus the traditional comparators, which would be what one could get in clinical medicine, which is conservative therapy. So both would be expected to compare favorably to conservative therapy. I wouldn't want to comment on vertebroplasty versus kyphoplasty. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And Dr. Paulop, Dr. Beal looks like he wants to weigh in on this also, operator. If Dr. Beal, if you have something specific to this question, but otherwise we're going to move on. Operator, if you could open his line.
Largest registry, U.S. registry, 792 patients. It had pain improvement from a 8.7 to a 2 in terms of numerical rating score, and pursuant to your question, had the Roland Morris disability improvement from a 21 to a 7. And this is mean functional improvement. So hopefully I'd like to touch on the cost of the procedures. Typically, a kyphoplasty kit is roughly $1,500 more than a vertebroplasty kit, and this is a rough statement. I realize that. There's two papers, one by Ong and Osteoporosis International in 2012 that showed it takes 2 years, but the medical management of vertebroplasty, because it's less effective in terms of pain reduction, is then at the two-year crossover, kyphoplasty becomes more effective, cost-effective, than vertebroplasty, and the other article is by Ansgar Lang, published in Spine in 2014. And that delta all is at 4 years, where the overlap between kyphoplasty becomes more cost-effective than vertebroplasty. So it's quality of treatment effect.
Thank you, Dr. Hill. Okay, I think at this point we'll move on to the next question. Doesn't appear to anybody else being in the queue. The next one is directed again at, I think, advocates of augmentation. The topic question, before we get to the discussion question, or the overarching question is number 10. If at least intermediate confidence, in other words, greater than or equal to 3, is noted in questions 1 or 5, and just to remind people that they were just the general questions of whether you think kyphoplasty or vertebroplasty, there's enough published evidence that you think you're confident, at least at a level of 3, that it improves clinical outcome. So if you're in that group, how confident are you that there is adequate evidence each of the following non-surgical management intervals be attempted without success before augmentation? 0 days, 1 to 7, 1 to 3, 3 to 6, or greater than 6 weeks. And again, when you get to the voting, each of these you would give a number to. But for the purpose of this discussion, we want to get a feel for where things stand as far as those who believe in augmentation. How long should there should the non-surgical management be tried? I think for Medicare coverage now, I think most of the MACs have something on the order of 6 to 12 weeks. But it does seem like that the trend of the main research, which I cited in the introduction, seems to be focusing more and more on the acute fracture, which would be less than 3 weeks. So I know that there's difference of opinion on this, and also there's some thought that maybe there's different indications for different time periods. But so the discussion question is, for each interval above that receives intermediate confidence, in other words, greater than or equal to 3, so if one or more was less than that, we don't necessarily, that's no confidence for that interval. We don't really need to discuss that. But those that one or more that had a rating of 3 or more, please discuss clinical parameters that would impact length of non-surgical management. Dr. Hirsch, you want to kick this off again?
Yeah, I think actually it's a really great question. So, you know, when we started doing this so many years ago, this seemed like such a dangerous procedure, and we all had this notion that fractures will heal. Therefore, in our own guidelines, we pushed for the notion of failing conservative therapy. And in fact, in my clinical practice, I offer conservative therapy not infrequently in discussions with patients and consultations in advance. I think that Greg makes an important point, and it's that with some of the publications, there's been a trend towards talking about sort of the hyperacute phase. And while it's not published, and I think we should be careful in terms of talking about results, there has been effort to differentiate acute from chronic fractures, and there is an ongoing trial looking at chronic fractures, in this case, vertebroplasty versus sham. What I would say is that Dr. John Barr and colleagues, and I was one of the colleagues, tried to tackle this question a number of years ago of what is a failure of conservative therapy? Is it defined by time? Is it defined by severity of the symptoms? Does it mean someone who's been admitted to the hospital and you can't get out of the hospital? And this was an effort to get at this sticky idea of what does it mean to fail conservative therapy, as there is no standardized definition of conservative therapy. And that was a real effort by Dr. Barr at that time. More recently, a multi-specialty group was brought together, all people that do augmentation, Using the ISMAR RAND approach, or the UCLA RAND approach, working with a company called ISMAR, and again, I was involved in this research. This group of 11 experts really downplayed the relevance of time, feeling that, again, situations should be thought about in terms of failures of other points rather than specifically time. So I think this is a very hot topic and important discussion, really one that I think consensus has been driving towards. We should think about this for a number of years. So with those introductory comments, Greg, do we have anybody in the queue?
Yeah, we do. And before we get to that, though, I would say that I misspoke when I defined acute as less than three. That's the sort of hyperacute that you were talking about, which does seem to be the focus. And I know it's been in the vapor, I think they emphasized to some extent the hyperacute population. But definitionally, I think acute is still defined as anything less than 6 weeks. And as far as the definition of a failed non-surgical management, question 12 does get to that. And just to read that, the 12, again, we'll wait till later to answer these, but that says, how confident are you that there is sufficient published evidence that each of the below is a reliable, valid, and meaningful indicator of failed non-surgical management? And then the each to be individually scored, pain precluding ambulation, pain precluding physical therapy, unacceptable side effects from non-surgical management, progression of vertebral height loss, persistence of at least moderate pain, and worsening kyphosis. And many of those were derived from society comments, what they recommended to be, how that those should be defined. I think we added several when we were developing the questions. We put these out to some subject matter experts to look at and suggest changes or additions. So. But yeah, I think that we have four in our queue now. Operator, can we get to the first question or comment? Operator?
Your next question line of Nelson Watts.
Yes, hello. This is Nelson Watts. I'm an endocrinologist, osteoporosis person in Cincinnati, Ohio. I represent the Endocrine Society, have no relevant conflicts of interest. Also a member of the American Society for Bone and Mineral Research, whose task force report was quoted earlier as showing no benefit to vertebroplasty. This is an opportunity to highlight the heterogeneity of two sides of the question. And the first question is, or issue is, if these procedures reduce pain, what is the mechanism? And one could be stabilization of the fracture, but the cement creates an exothermic reaction as it cures, so it could be heat. But fractures are different. Where's the location? Is it a mild fracture, severe fracture? Is there a cleft? Timing is important. And the procedures themselves sound like they're the same, but vertebroplasty in one hand is not the same as vertebroplasty in someone else's hand. How much cement is put in, what type of cement. And I was thinking, what would happen if I had a painful vertebral fracture and someone asked me to be in a sham-controlled trial and said, if you don't participate in the trial, we can go ahead and do the procedure anyway. I'm concerned that there's a selection bias for patients who may be less severely affected who would say yes to participation in a trial. So as important as these numeric endpoints are, I would argue that it's unless you have much more homogeneity in defining what type and other parameters of the fracture and much more consistency in how the procedures are performed, that we're not nearly as smart as we think we are. That's my comment.
Thank you.
Nelson, I want to just thank you. That's a really terrific comment highlighting several different important points. It is very hard to achieve a homogeneous population in any of these trials, and I do think that has been a challenge as we've tried to do some of these. That amongst the many other excellent points you made. Thank you. I didn't mean to jump in.
Operator, we can get to the next comment.
Your next question line of Dr. John Barr.
Is my line open now?
Yes.
Good. Hi, I am an interventional neuroradiologist who practices at UT Southwestern in Dallas, and I'm a former president of the American Society of Spine Radiology, who I represent today. I think all of these comments are great, but there are two fundamental issues that we really haven't discussed. One, which is with regard to a waiting period, that this would essentially be the only bone in the body that we consider a trial of doing nothing rather than fixation for a fracture. And the other is the issue of safety of this procedure. That has been questioned by some, that this might not be safe or we don't know how safe it is. And I would challenge that, in fact, now with 15 reported randomized trials, we know precisely how safe this is. From a recent presentation I gave at a meeting, there are 1,098 patients who were treated with augmentation in the 15 trials. Of those nearly 1,100 patients, there are 16 reported procedural complications. That's 1.5%. And of those complications, many are trivial. There are only two patients that had significant complications, one with osteomyelitis, one with a respiratory arrest from sedation, which is a 0.18% serious adverse event rate, and the mortality in these 1,098 augmented patients is zero from the procedure. So I think we have absolute ironclad data that this is an extremely safe procedure. You know, how did we get to the question of waiting? In the beginning, when we started doing this, and I've been doing this now for 25 years, we didn't know how safe it was. It was a very novel procedure, so we tended to only treat patients who had exhausted all other traditionally accepted therapies. As we understood how safe this was and became confident, we started treating patients earlier and earlier. I will also add from personal experience, both of my parents have had osteoporotic vertebral compression fractures for a total of four between them. Every single one of those fractures was treated within 48 hours of identification. Thank you.
Dr. Brawl, were they particularly symptomatic?
Yes. They were in severe pain.
Were they hospitalized?
Actually, yes. My mother was hospitalized. I will also speak to the lack of clinical follow-up in some of the trials. My mother had an initial excellent response that lasted about 72 hours. Then she told me her pain had returned almost to baseline. I knew instantly what she had. She had a new fracture. But some of the negative trials that we placed stock in had absolutely no clinical follow-up. So when those patients did poorly, who knows what happened to them? And all of us who do this know that having new fractures is extremely common.
Thank you, Dr. Barr. Dr. Hirsch, do you have any follow-up there you want to say?
I think that, Dr. Barr, his paper is in the bibliography, and the bibliography did make efforts to include lots of different papers with different perspectives. I think that one of the debates that I helped launch and lost was the question of whether or not adjacent body fractures occurred more commonly after vertebral augmentation. In the recent paper that was cited by our colleague from Endocrine, there were questions raised about whether that question has been answered, but I would say that there has been no randomized controlled trial that I know of that shows a statistically significant difference between either the control group or sham group and the augmented vertebrae. So let me repeat that. There has been no trial that has demonstrated a difference. And what that likely means is that there is a component of natural history involved in the development of additional fractures. I think that that's important because that is a question that comes up quite a bit with our clinical colleagues from rheumatology or from endocrinology. I know you mentioned there were four people in the queue, so I'll be quiet again.
Thank you. Operator, I think we can go to the next questioner or commenter.
And your next question comes from Deborah Tracy.
Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we
can you hear me? Yes? Oh, okay. My name is Dr. Deborah Tracy. I practice in Florida in the J9 jurisdiction. I've been a CAC member since 2007. I am board certified in anesthesiology, subspecialty certified in interventional pain, fellowship trained in interventional pain by three separate organizations, including the American Board of Anesthesiology. I trained in vertebroplasty in 1999, and since then have done thousands of vertebroplasty and kyphoplasty, and my practice is 90% Medicare. I practice in Hernando County, which is one of the top counties for Medicare per capita, and the hospital I practice in is a 350-bed hospital that is 80% Medicare. So I would like to address the neurologist question.
Do you have any conflict of interest that are relevant?
I do teach for the Stryker company maybe once to three times a year, and that involves teaching other doctors how to do the procedure. Is that adequate, sir?
Yes, yes.
Thank you. I would like to address the neurologist comment. And for this problem, what we're dealing with is the sedentary restrictions of having a vertebral compression fracture. And this is outside the domain of the literature that we have been reviewing, but we know from other literature in the osteoporotic literature that bone density declines 2% per week with bone loss. Most dramatic in the first 12 weeks for patients 70, 80, and 90 years old. Muscle strength declines 1 to 3% per day, 10 to 15% per week to half normal strength at 3 to 5 weeks. And the patients are at risk of developing pressure sores. They have side effects from opioid analgesics. As they develop a kyphosis, they develop rib crowding, decreased lung capacity, and their sedentary lifestyle can lead to DVT, pulmonary embolism, and pneumonia. So I hope that for the neurologist who asked the question, that answers it. Additionally, the vertebroplasty procedure is basically putting a needle through the pedicle. Most of us use the transpedicular approach and then putting the cement in. The kyphoplasty procedure involves putting the needle in, then a drill to drill through perhaps sclerotic bone, then a balloon or a cavity cutter, and this has been suggested to decrease the incidence of extravasation because you're decreasing the pressure within the bone. And this is what results in the increased cost. So the vertebroplasty procedure basically would move forward a little faster than the kyphoplasty procedure, and the kyphoplasty procedure would be more costly because of the extra equipment used. In terms of what Dr. Beal commented on, I would further like to say that in the Butchbinder study of 2009, 67% of the patients came from a single site. I would wonder if the FDA would qualify this as a multicenter trial. And the primary variable was mean pain, not responder analysis. So I would question with the sample size they achieved if the FDA would require a responder analysis. So I think what Dr. Beal said was that to achieve a difference of 1 point from the mean, either way, the sample size in the Butchbinder 2009 study would have to be 120 participants per group, and it was only 35 and 38 per group. So the means and the confidence levels are inadequate to determine the distribution of properties. Again, the sample size was too small. And I would like to refer you to the task force report, the second task force report of 2019. We have Dr. Butchbinder and Dr. Kalmes as participants in that paper, and they do say pretty strongly that sample size is very important on page 7, bullet 2, and page 18. And they do say that the studies must have adequate power on page 7, bullet 9, and page 18. Yet there's no commentary or thoughtful commentary on the inadequacies of those papers that are referenced later in the task force paper that analyze how the literature should be provided. So I would wonder why they didn't reference the literature from 2009 as to its inadequacies. In terms of Dr. Barr's comments, I would totally agree with Dr. Barr. It's really hard to define a fracture. An acute fracture is something we never knew was there. It's acute. It has marrow edema. But what I see here in this patient, they can have a chronic fracture for years, and then it becomes acute on chronic, and it progresses. So another problem that's not addressed in the literature is, does the stabilization of the bone and the stabilization of the height of the bone improve the patient's future in terms of progression of the fracture? In terms of our endocrinologist comment, our neuroendocrinologist, I think that's exactly right. One of the biggest problems in all the literature referenced is the homogeneity. And if further studies are recommended by the task force, I would recommend that the time of the fracture, the type, the integrity of the bone, if there's spinal stenosis, what I often see or people get a compression fracture fixed, if they come back and say, oh, my pain is worse than ever, I say, well, you know, here's where we did that. Is this where it hurts? Oh, no, that pain's totally gone. Now I have pain in this place. So I think one of the other problems in the literature is that there are no efforts to determine when the pain scale doesn't decrease, if they are comorbid spinal conditions that are at different sites, or, as Dr. Barr said, if there are progressing fractures. I saw an elderly lady who was in a motor vehicle accident. She had one single fracture, and we repaired that fracture, but she didn't get better. Well, we did an MRI within the 2 weeks of the repair, and there was a fracture above it. So I think that evolved infraction just fracture did not show itself until later on and was probably beginning to fracture at the point where I saw her. Thank you very much. I hope I didn't take too much time.
Dr. Tracy, one question. Do you think that in Virtus 4, the groups were homogeneous enough to compare to reach a good comparison?
You know, right off, I could answer that question later, but at the moment there was so much literature, I really don't remember my opinion of that specific problem in that specific paper. But I can answer that at a later time for you.
Okay, thank you. Operator, if we could go on to the next commenter.
And your next question comes from Dr. Catherine Parks.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, so I don't want to take up too much time. I am a pain doctor from Indiana, board certified in pain medicine, and I specialize in treatment of spine. I agree with all the comments that have been already made.
And any conflict of interest? Do you have any conflict of interest?
No, I have no conflict of interest at all. I'm in private practice.
Okay.
Yes. So I agree with all the comments that have been made in favor of vertebroplasty, and there was one short study that showed there was an adjacent fracture. The study was 78 people. I can't remember the name right now. There were 7 adjacent fractures that occurred after vertebroplasty. That's the only thing that I think I saw that referred to any adjacent fractures that occurred. So I agree that there's not enough research. If there's a return of pain, there needs to be other studies performed and not just call it a failure of the vertebroplasty. And my own father suffered severely, could not move, had vertebroplasty by an interventional radiologist, because I don't do them. And he was fine within hours of having the procedure. So you cannot deny this to patients who need it. We cannot deny it just because there is not enough literature. So that's all I need to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Operator, the next commenter, please.
And your next question line of Dr. Patricia Beyer.
Oh, hi. I'm a CAC member. I'm a general surgeon representing the Florida chapter. I don't have any conflict of interest. I'm just curious about the studies that show no improvement of pain. If those studies were done after the patient was on opioids for a period of time, would not that interfere with the patient's improvement? Because if you're on opioids for any more than a week or so, now that we know about the opioid epidemic, someone would continue to think they have pain because of their opioid addiction, no? So I was wondering if there's any studies that, like, tease that part out of it.
We could open that to subject matter experts, but I can probably help with this, Dr. Haug. So I just want to clarify first, the studies versus the basis of the challenge to vertebral augmentation in the Cochrane review and or the recently published paper in JVMR is not that vertebroplasty didn't work. Vertebroplasty has historically worked in all of these trials. It's the performance of the sham arm. And I think that's just an important distinction that was made by one of the other subject matter experts earlier. And the subject of opioids is extremely important, and clearly many of these patients are on opioids. And in fact, in a different era, many of us thought they really should be on opioids before we would go ahead and offer augmentation, meaning that was considered an active part of conservative therapy. Thankfully, after years of thinking that and a lot of, I think, challenges to not thinking that way, I think there's been an evolution in thought about what conservative therapy should look like. But I would say, in answer to your question, clearly a large percentage of patients in the trials are on opioids, and the one of the benchmarks that the trials use is how well people do coming off opioids once they've been treated. And I would say that across the plurality of real-world comparator studies, vertebral augmentation offers a significant advantage in that case. I would open the comments up open to other subject matter experts.
Operator, if we can go to the next commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Melissa Chambers.
Hello, this is Renee.
Yes, we can hear you.
I'm a neurosurgeon at UAB. I'm representing the American Association of Neurologic Surgeons, and I have no conflict of interest. I would like to only reiterate the comments of both Nelson and Josh. When they made what I think is one of the most important findings to date, that is there are many unique combinations of clinical and imaging factors that might affect not only accurate diagnosis, but also treatment choices. So I think this particular issue, we've sort of skirted around it because, as Dr. Hirsch pointed out, we have so many randomized controlled trials. We have so many studies. You know, we have prospective and retrospective patient experience reviews. I think probably this has been addressed thoroughly by both the European and the American clinical care pathways that were developed by the multi-specialty panel with the RAN-UCLA appropriateness method. You know, Dr. Hirsch mentioned he was part of that. I was as well in the American pathway. My point is there are so many different factors involved here. You know, presently we're talking about non-surgical management interval of time. And then as we go to question 12, we'll be looking at pain and its progression, loss of vertebral body height and its progression, progression of symptoms in general, impact on daily activities, advanced imaging findings, and so on. I think timing is just one factor among all of these. In my opinion and my experience, you know, we published in 2015 an article that's not on the list, just the patient experience following over 200 patients. And I think the patient experiences significant, rapid, sustained reduction of pain, improved quality of life, reduced disability, and a low complication rate. I think we've all agreed those are relatively common findings, agreed upon findings. I think that timely repair of the fracture is indicated not only to prevent complications that Dr. Tracy pointed out associated with prolonged inactivity, but also just for humane and effective treatment of severe pain in the acute setting. But if we go to the literature, I think the clinical care pathways are the closest we can come to addressing each of these factors in their unique combinations to say, yes, literature does provide reliable, valid information to use for treatment choices. That's all I had.
Dr. Chambers, and you're familiar with Virtuos 4, right?
I am.
So in that case, the sham, similar to the New England Journal studies, was in itself a form of treatment. Would you agree with that?
Now, remind me, I say I'm familiar with it. Is this the bupivacaine?
Yeah, and periosteal injection of bupivacaine.
Yes, yes. I think that is an active sham.
Okay. And they didn't find a statistical difference. I guess you could argue if you increased the numbers enough that maybe even a small difference would be statistically significant. Do you think that that itself, that injection, periosteal injection, should be part of the treatment algorithm? In
part
some
of the
form?
Treatment of fractures?
Yeah, I mean it was an active treatment, and its results were equivalent, arguably, to the vertebroplasty. So, should that be tried alternatively to vertebroplasty, or at least
I
be
think
part
you're...
of?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I think those are two different treatments for two different problems. I think what happens is the injection introduces yet one more confounding variable into these trials. Where is the bupivacaine going? Are you simply infusing anesthetic subperiosteally, or are you providing a medial branch block? Are you injecting the facet joint pain? Are you injecting into the musculoskeletal tissue and relieving myofascial pain? I think these are two separate issues. I don't think that you want to compare vertebroplasty to this injection. I think, as I was stating about the unique combinations of pre-treatment findings, I think you have to do your very best to make an appropriate diagnosis and decide what you're treating. I don't think you just need to, like the label trial, just take bupivacaine and inject it to then say, well, this was not the result of relief in the INVEST trial. You know, I think these are just two completely different things. I think you'll muddy the water if you try to create a trial comparing sort of a random subperiosteal injection to a procedure specifically to stop the fracture pain.
Well, I mean,
does that make sense?
I
think there are.
Yeah, no, but I would push back a little in that, you know, the authors of Virtuos 4 themselves, again, these were highly selected patients, and unlike the 2009 studies, I think the two groups there were better patient selection, and presumably it wasn't just this periosteal wasn't so random. They presumably did it in a consistent fashion, and they themselves say the results suggest that periosteal infiltration alone in the early phase provides enough pain relief with no need for additional cementation. So it seems like they're suggesting that should be one of the treatments that are tried and fail before vertebroplasty.
Yeah, and I would, yeah, I don't think I'm knowledgeable enough about Vertos-4 to respond to that reasonably, but I would say I'd still go back to these clinical pathways and say, I think you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. You're saying, let's do a trial and treat them all like this, when you're not going back to these unique combinations of findings in these patients. And just like you pointed out, I think bottom line, patient selection would be essential. I would be very careful not to treat a fracture that has caused kyphosis, caused postural change, caused, you know, all of the known problems we have with osteoporotic vertebral fractures, and try to stop the pain with a bupivacaine injection when you're not treating the other problems.
Okay, Dr. Chambers.
I don't think that would be appropriate.
We've got people stacking up in the queue, so we're going to have to get to that. But I would just remind people that the question here is about the interval. You know, assuming that we agree that augmentation is useful, it's about the interval that should be weight that should precede. You know, does the fracture have to be acute? Can it be subacute? Can it be chronic?
And may I ask, just I don't want to take too much time, but Dr. Hirsch, you're probably much more familiar with how the intervals were addressed in the RAND UCLA appropriateness method paper. And I think they were divided 0 to 1, 1 to 3, 3 to 6, and greater than 6. Again, could you explain how that factors into the multiple combinations of treatment, and if you think that publication addresses that adequately?
Thank you, Renee. I think you took over the job of co-moderator. I want to be respectful of the fact that we have a lot of people in the queue. I'll say two quick things related to the questions that have been posed. The first is, and I would make people aware that there is some background noise that is best by people muting their phones so that we're respectful of all the people that are on the call. So if you're not muted and not speaking, please mute yourself. With respect to the RAND, the RAND study, we looked at multiple different parameters, and it was actually a surprising consensus opinion and a strongly held consensus opinion that timing should be deemed less important than these other factors. With respect to the question that Dr. Chambers was answering for Dr. Hogg, I think we can simplify Dr. Hogg's question, which is that if the sham trials demonstrated that the active control sham did better than expected, would that be a reasonable step on a clinical care pathway, not one that was employed in the RAND UCLA trial, but one going forward? I have my own biases on the answer to that question, which I've actually shared with Dr. Hogg, but I think we should throw that back to subject matter experts.
Thank you. Operator, if we could open the line for the next commenter.
Your next question line of Dr. Jeffrey Koh.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm an orthopedic spine surgeon in California. Represent the California CAC. I have no current conflicts, although I did participate in the CAS trial about 3 to 4 years ago and got some research support. But again, no current conflicts except for the fact I take care of patients with fractures. So far, I believe I'm the only orthopedic surgeon that has spoken regarding this. The principles of fracture care have to be kept in mind, and I think there's meta-analysis and other studies that suggest the mortality rates from vertebral compression fractures approach that of hip fractures. And I think we have to understand, and I want to reiterate the comment of the endocrinologist colleague that spoke earlier, that this is a heterogeneous population. And I think all of these studies, including this recent Vertos studies, but particularly the two very disproportionately high impact trials in 2009, Bookbinder and Calmus, although they're randomized controlled trials, we've been seduced by the fact that they're randomized controlled trials published in prestigious journals. And the reality is the definition of evidence-based medicine is high-quality randomized controlled trials, and I'm